here's my story I should tell. Welcome to our fifth installment of Untold Stories. I think this is the first time I've ever stood at a pulpit. It's a little intimidating. A fundraiser for the Palmer Museum. My name is Kai West, and I'm the MC for the program. We have 8 untold stories for you this evening. And this is the first time that we are being hosted by the United Protestant Presbyterian Church, or the Old Log Church, as it's so lovingly named. How fitting it is that we are sitting in the oldest church in the valley, a church that was built in 1935. So, let's get an historical perspective from a woman who knows this church very well. Here is Betty Pierce and the Pollock Pew. Give her a round of applause.
You can just take it out. I'm just going to hold it like this. Can you guys hear me? Okay, good. Hey, I came here in July just to try to find Tim and Lisa Carrick, because I thought, who better to tell a story at the church about redemption, reunions, and revivals than the pastors of this church? Well, when I got here, the building was dark and the office hours were posted that the office was closed. And I just couldn't help myself. I stepped forward and I grabbed the door handle and I went to turn it and it opened. And I came in. This sanctuary drew me in. It was dark. I came to the Pollock pew. It's in the back there. When I grew up here, this was our church. My family, when they moved to Alaska in 1958, my mom wrote this church to see if it would be a suitable place for our family to worship in. And it was. As I sat in the pew in the semi-darkness and the smell of these logs, all the memories came back. All at once, I was one of the 6 children in the pew, kind of really wriggling around when the sermon was going on. I couldn't really pay attention. So Mom would get the pocketbook up and get her roll of lifesavers out, and she'd get a lifesaver for each one of us wiggly little children. That was me and my brothers and sisters, and that would hush us up. If that didn't work, my dad at the end of the pew would look down, put his finger to his mouth, and give us that look. And that usually hushed us up. I remember looking up on the walls of this log church, and there was some of my artwork up here, and I was so excited that I would study it. When the sermon didn't really hold me, there was the Apostle Paul that I had done in 3D. It was a relief with his face, and it was in paper mache, and I was so thrilled with it. And I would study it and think, oh, I did that. We had vacation Bible schools here in this church in July, rainy Julys, when I didn't really want to come to town. We lived up on Lazy Mountain. I didn't want to come to town and go to vacation Bible school, but my mom was a teacher here, so I came to town with my brothers and sisters for that. And then when I was too old for a class, I was a helper in a class. So this church, in the front row, Nancy Ivy on Sundays would be up front. She was this wonderful Southern lady, one of the parishioners here in this church, and she would smile, just this beatific smile at all us at the church. And when it was meet and greet time, she'd get up and she'd smile, and if you got close enough, she'd hug you. And in the service, I was always afraid that she might clap or raise her hands, because I didn't think Presbyterians raised their hands in church. But Nancy was a joyful Christian lady. There was a lady named Mrs. Blum who came to church, and she had a real fancy white Mercedes-Benz, and she always was dressed to the nines, and I just thought, wow, she has that all together. One Saturday, Mom and I were working downstairs in the church, and Mrs. Blum came too, and she didn't look so good, and I said, Mom, what's wrong with Mrs. Blum? And she said, Betty Margaret, let that be a lesson to you. When you wear too much makeup and you don't wear it, you look sick. Yeah. There were epic potlucks here in this church when I was growing up. Downstairs, there would be tables just laden with food. And Mrs. Rempel, Mary Rempel, made the most amazing cream puffs. They were flaky on the outside and creamy on the inside. And we'd always have a prayer before we got to eat. And I would scope out where Mrs. Rempel's cream puffs were so that I could line myself up to snag one, because there weren't very many. And we had to grab one before they all went. my mom sang here in the choir. The choir loft is behind us, and my mom sang here every Sunday. She had choir service, choir practice at 7 o'clock on Thursday nights, and it was a break for her and not a break for my dad, though. He had to take care of all of us when mom came down for practice. I can still see her standing back here with her blue robe on and her white collar, her arms outstretched, her glasses halfway down her nose, focusing on the choir director so intently. She loved to sing. At Christmas time, the candlelight Christmas service, the choir would sing and have special music many times. 11 o'clock on Christmas Eve, the choir would be back here singing special music, and at the end of the service, they would hand out candles to everyone in the audience and into the choir loft, and we'd light them, and then the choir would descend down and go out the alleyway, go out the aisle here with their candles, and they were singing, and I'm in the Politburo, and I'm like, Mom, Mom, look at me, look at me. But she was so intent on walking, holding her candle, going straight ahead, and singing that she never looked at me. But Bob Rowland looked at me and smiled, and one time Dossie Boyd did too, I remember. On Christmas night, after the Christmas Eve service, and the choir was all back there at the end singing, and the song was over, they would gather the children, and they'd hand little mesh bags full of hard candy and nuts and a mandarin orange, maybe two if you were lucky. That was Christmas. There were weddings and funerals in this church here for our family. And the wedding, most of my brothers and sisters got married here in this church, and I got married here too. And when I got married, I thought, I want my dad to walk me down this aisle in a black tux. I could just see it. I'd be beautiful in my white dress, and he'd be in his black tux. It'd be amazing. Well, when I said to him, Dad, I want you to wear a tux, he's like, Betty Margaret, I've always wanted an Alaskan tuxedo. And I what? And he said, I've always wanted one, and you're my last daughter to get married, and I really want one. And I was like, oh. Well, for those of you that don't know what an Alaskan tuxedo is, it's a wool-rich type jacket that comes down about mid-thigh and trousers, and it's made out of a heavy wool. And you buy them at Brewster's when the Brewster store was still around, and they lasted forever. Well, I loved my dad. So when I walked down this aisle in my white dress, I was on the arm of my dad in a light green Alaskan tuxedo. There are many funerals that happened in this church as well. I remember John DeVries, he was a well-loved teacher here at Palmer High, and there was a service for him. And Leroy Nord, I think he's in the audience even, stood up and had remarks and just made everybody laugh about all the happy memories they had of John DeVries. It was a great funeral. In 1971, my brother Don died in a plane crash, an Alaskan Airlines plane crash outside of Juneau. His memorial service was here. I remember being in that front row. I was 10 years old. I just wanted to crawl into the pew. The place was packed with people. What I didn't know was that all the parishioners were grieving as well. My brother was 18. He was on his way to college, and he was loved by this congregation. Some 40 years later, a middle-aged Betty stood up here with her two sisters eulogizing our father who passed away. He was an integral part of this church and an elder. Then, which shouldn't have been much of a surprise, that 4 months later, our mother passed away suddenly, and so my sisters and I were up here again paying tribute to our mother. They were an integral part of this church, very special. This church is a church of 1,000 trees. It's been around since 1935. The colonists built it. The first service was in May of 1935 in a tent. By 1936, they had had a building erected. In 1980, it was listed in the National Historic Register, National Register of Historic Places. This church is nearly 82 years old. When the colonists first came, the government gave 3 plots of land for the churches to build in Palmer, and the Catholics got a plot, the Lutherans got a section, and all the rest of us got a section. That was this church. So it's nearly 82 years old now, and it was loved by my family, the Pollocks. And hey, you guys in the back in the Pollock pew, got to scoot over, because I'm coming back.
Nice job. Thank you, Betty, for that great story. Wonderful historical perspective. Our theme tonight is reunions, revivals, and redemptions. People think that stories are shaped by people. In fact, it's the other way around. A quote by Terry Pratchett. Maybe that's a little bit of what happened to Kendra Zamzow. Here she is sharing her story called Till Dutch Do We Part. Let's give a round of applause.
Thanks, Kai. So in the 1980s, in Willow, Alaska, there was a dog musher, had a sled dog handler by the name of Bronco, B-R-A-N-K-O. He was from Yugoslavia. At the same time, I was a sled dog handler in Trapper Creek. So time went by, and pretty soon Bronco's visa was about to come up, about to expire. So his musher and my musher got their heads together and thought, wouldn't it be a great idea if Kendra and Bronco got married? Well, well, Bronco and I were the same age, and he was strong, blonde, blue-eyed, the very definition of Slavic. And I was a little wild, so we got married in Anchorage at the sled dog shop, 4th and D. Pretty informal. I did have a white dress. He had a blue tux. Then he went back to work in Willow, and I went back to work in Trapper Creek. Worked through the winter. Summer came around, and I called him up. I said, hey, Bronco, I'm going to head down to Kisilov and go back to work at a fish processing plant. Do you want to come with me? He said, yeah, sure. So I gassed up my truck, threw my six dogs in the back and Bronco in the front, and we drove on down to Kisilov. Rented a little cabin above the Kisilov River before it got all crazy down there. We lived in the same little cabin together. We worked at the same plant together. But after a time, it became apparent that we didn't fit that well together. Over the summer, the relationship deteriorated, and Bronco decided to go to Anchorage and see if he could get on with the Carpenters Union and make some real money. And I stayed on at the fish plant, working there in the summers, started getting work as a fisheries observer in the winters. And that was work where you go out for 2 or 3 months at a time on usually a large catcher-processor boat in the Gulf of Alaska or the Bering Sea. And you collect the biological data on the species that are being brought aboard. So about a year and a half had gone by since Bronco had gone to Anchorage, and I hadn't been in contact with him. I was down in Dutch Harbor working as an observer, had come in off of one boat, was waiting for the next boat to arrive, and my company was sparing no expense while I was on land, putting me up at the Captain's Bay Lodge, which was a collection of Atco trailers about 5 miles out of town. So if you think Dutch is remote, go another 5 miles. So I'd basically traded a bunk and a steel floor and a cafeteria on a floating man camp for a cot and a linoleum floor and a cafeteria for a man camp outside of Dutch. And I was pretty tired of bunkmates and cafeterias and looking forward to another 3 months of that. So I called up a taxi. I just wanted to go to town, have a couple of drinks, a restaurant meal, just relax. Just relax for a little while. So I call the taxi, and this white van comes rattling up to the door, and I jump in, and we rattle trap on down this long road to town. I'm kind of staring out the window. Something catches my eye. I go, wait, stop, wait, that's my husband. And there's Bronco walking down the side of the road, miles from town. So I jump out, I go, Bronco, what the hell are you doing here? Well, he had got on with the Carpenters Union, and they'd sent him to Dutch Harbor to work on the Unicee plant that was a really big construction project at the time. So the cab took us down to a pizza place. We got out, ordered a great big pizza, and we're laughing and joking and talking and catching up and just really enjoying each other the way two people do when they've met unexpectedly in a faraway place. Even if you didn't know the person that well or you weren't the best of friends, you have this fondness of familiarity when you're in a strange place. So we were feeling that and enjoying each other. And we were eating this pizza and occasionally glancing at this TV up on the wall of this pizza place. And starting to go into that carbohydrate coma. And pretty soon, we weren't talking anymore. We were just watching that TV. And I became very conscious that I was in this bubble of warmth and companionship in this cold place on the spine of the Aleutians, holding the hand of this man from Yugoslavia who had left a communist country and he'd made his way to Alaska. And together we were watching the fall of the Berlin Wall. It was November of 1989. So I didn't see Bronco again after that. We traded some letters back and forth, documents and paperwork for an annulment. Less than a year later, after I'd seen him, his own country disintegrated in the Balkan Wars. But as far as I know, Bronco is still in Alaska. And that's my story. Chinan.
Such interesting stories. Thank you, Terry. I mean, not Terry. You are Kendra. Stories are for joining the past to the future. Stories are for those late hours in the night when you can't remember how you got from where you are to where you were, where you were to where you are. Stories are for eternity, when memory is erased and when there is nothing to remember except the story. That's a quote from Tim O'Brien. Butch Halford would now share his untold story, and it's called Long Time No See. Let's welcome him.
Before I begin, I'd like to observe that here I am standing behind a pulpit in a church on Sunday. So I'd like to apologize in advance for any unscheduled lightning bolts that may come near. Did you ever get a surprise message that you weren't expecting? Well, I got one once. I was at a public meeting at the Captain Cook Hotel in Anchorage. It was on some new regulation they were doing, and we broke for lunch, and I was on the far side of the room, and so as we left, I was one of the last ones to go out. And that was before there were cell phones. And right outside the door was a little corkboard easel with those pink "while you were out" stickers. I didn't expect a message. I never got messages. But I saw my name, so I looked, and it says, Butch, call home, ASAP, underlined 3 times. Well, I knew immediately what was wrong. Somebody died. Or maybe the pipes froze and the house was flooded. But what else could it be? So I walked over to the payphones and called home. Didn't even finish one ring, and my wife answered. And she said, I talked to your dad. And she was talking really fast, and she doesn't normally. But she, I said, could you say that again? You talked to your dad? And I said, no, I talked to your dad, your father. Well, that was pretty surprising. And because as it happened, I hadn't seen or heard from my dad in 28 years. And we had been kind of half-heartedly trying to find him. And finally something did happen. So I went home, and you know, quickly as I could, she met me at the door, and she got a phone in one hand and a piece of paper with his number in the other. And you know, I said, call him, call him, call him. And she had tried to tell me that he lives in Pensacola and you've got two brothers and blah, blah, blah. She was talking faster than an auctioneer. And I only got, you know, every third word, but I knew that, you know, this was a big event. So the last time I had seen him was just after my freshman year in high school. And this all happened in 1994. So the math, that was in 1966. And when I'd seen him that last time, he had told me he was in the Navy and he was nearing retirement. And his plan was, after he retired, to move to Rota, Spain. He had spent tours of duty there and liked the area and planned to retire there. And my wife and I tried to track him down a couple of times through long-distance information, which didn't help any. Nobody here by that name. But a few months before he called, my wife had seen a program on TV of adults that were looking for their birth parents. And while I wasn't adopted, she said that the Salvation Army had a person finding service that might fit. So we contacted them, and they had a pretty narrow set of circumstances. You couldn't be looking for money, you couldn't be looking for a new kidney or two or three other different things that you can't be doing. But I filled out the form they sent me and sent it in with $10 and never heard another word. And in fact, it was about 6 months. Well, it turned out the lady at the Salvation Army that processed these had a heart attack and spent like the next 3 months recuperating. So when she finally came back, she did it. And so on St. Patrick's Day in 94, my dad got his Social Security check, and an extra piece of paper fell out of it with the form that said, the below-named person is trying to reach you. Here's his number. If you want to talk to him, you may. Getting reunited was exciting, and it was kind of frightening. So I got home, and I called. Didn't really know what I was going to say. But I dialed the number, and there's this old, tiny, feeble-sounding voice answered. And I, well, that can't be him, because I knew that my dad had a voice like Charlton Heston, let my people go. But, you know, time had gone by, and it was my dad. And one of the things that the Salvation Army document said, if they find him, they'll tell him you're looking for him and how to get a hold of you, but they don't do anything else. So if I didn't hear from him, I didn't know if that meant they didn't find him, or if they found him and he didn't want to talk to me. But he did. I talked to him for an hour, and I said, well, I better go and call my sister, Cindy, and tell her I tracked you down. And he said, oh, no, I got her number from your wife. I already talked to her for an hour or two. Well, it turned out I didn't just find my dad. I had two grown brothers that I didn't know existed, and they all lived in Pensacola, Florida. He had, in Spain, gone to the Navy doctor there and was diagnosed with cancer, and the guy told him, he said, you know, if you want a fighting chance with this, you're going to have to go home. So he looked around and found out Pensacola was a good place for military retirees and medical care, and that's where they all wound up. The older brother had a Spanish woman wife, and my dad had a wife, and neither one of them spoke English or drove, or they got a different kind of marriage rules in Spain, it turns out. My younger brother married his high school sweetheart from Pensacola, and she set him straight right away that our marriage isn't going to be like theirs. So at any rate, my sister and I flew there in May, and they met us at the airport, took us home. And, you know, we spent the weekend reminiscing and recapping our lives and getting together. And my sister got really quiet, and she had big curly hair. She grabbed it and started to walk out quietly. And my dad said, "Where are you going? What's wrong?" She turned and she says, "I've spent my entire life with the biggest wise ass in the world, and now I'm in a room with four clones." Although we had, you know, I'd only lived with my dad until I started kindergarten, so I didn't really get the imprint that you would expect, but the similarities between him and my two brothers and me was eerie to the point of being creepy. Getting reunited was pretty traumatic for my mom, because my mom thought that me and my sister and I would fall in love with him and forget all about her. But, you know, I could tell that she needed some reassurance, and I told her, "Hey, you know, this guy might turn out to be an angel or a jackass or somewhere in between, but until then, all he is a stranger with an above-average letter of introduction." And so it all worked out fine. Getting reunited with him got me reunited with his side of the family, too, because they hadn't heard from him in that long either. And the next year, he and his wife and my uncle, Dwayne, and his wife came to Alaska to visit. And that was an experience. My uncle, Dwayne, was colorful to say the least. We played cards, we told stories, we went sightseeing. He and my dad both bellyached every entire time they were here about how cold it was. And it was one of the nicest summers we'd ever had. But, you know, it became apparent that tall tales ran rampant in our family. And I called my Uncle Dwayne on it a couple of times. And he said, "Let me set you straight on something. We Halfords are often in error, but we're never in doubt." We don't exaggerate. We don't embellish. But you know that Ted Turner guy that takes the old black and white movies and colorizes them? That's what we do. We take black and white stories and add color.
Reunions. Someone once said, "Finding an old friend is like finding a lost pearl, for an old friend takes a long time to grow." And here is Janet Aslin to share her story about an unexpected reunion. Let's welcome her.
How I let my sister talk me into this, I'm not sure. I've seen ancient maps that show Jerusalem as the center of the world. And I think that's still true today. I live in Jerusalem, and as I ride the bus or as I walk down the streets in the city center, I hear Hebrew, of course, English, Arabic, Russian, French, Spanish, and Asian languages. I have no idea what they are. The world actually is coming to Jerusalem, is coming to Israel. So in a way, it's not surprising that I had an unexpected reunion in the city of Jerusalem. We have to go back to the first time I went, which was 2002. Israel had never really been of interest to me. It hadn't been on my radar screen. But I got a letter from an organization I was part of, and they were going on a tour in May. And one sentence, it was just like a light bulb went on in my head. And I thought, I'm going. I didn't know why. I didn't know how I could afford it. At the time, I was married, and my husband wasn't working. He wasn't able to work at the time. But I just knew that I knew that I knew that I was going to go. So about 3 weeks after I had read the letter and got this light bulb experience, I actually had a windfall of finances, so there was my money. I didn't say that my husband wasn't really thrilled with the idea of me going to the Middle East, because it does have a reputation. And after I'd gotten the money, I went home and I said, Mark, I've got the money for the trip. Now you're going to sit down until you give me your blessing to go. He didn't have much choice with that, so he did. And as I was preparing for the trip, of course I talked about it a lot. All my friends knew I was going, and I have a friend named Victoria, who has a friend named Debbie, who had a friend in Jerusalem named Joan. I didn't know Debbie and I didn't know Joan, but Victoria contacted me and said, my friend Debbie would like you to bring some things to Jerusalem for Joan, if you're willing. And I said, well, I'm a light packer. Sure, I can do that. So Debbie and I met at MTA over in Palmer where I was working, and she walked into the lobby with a fairly big-sized bag. Now, in her defense, she did say that if there was something I couldn't take, didn't have room for, that she I wouldn't have to take it. But I took it all. I am a light packer, and I took it all. So now I'm on the tour in Israel, and I imagine all of you have been on tours before, and they keep you really, really busy. So I'm thinking, how on earth am I going to connect with a woman that I don't know in a city that I've never been to before? I did have her phone number, of course. But how am I going to deliver this package that I've got for her? It did take a few tries before we connected, and she made arrangements to meet me at the hotel where I was staying. So we had a wonderful talk. It turns out that Joan actually lived in Palmer. I didn't know her when she lived here, but she lived here a number of years before she and Eric made Aliyah or moved to Israel. So we had a great talk. But the surprise of the evening came when Eric, her husband, came to pick her up. I was sitting just across from her, and he walked up behind her. And I looked up, and I said, Eric Knutson, I don't believe it. He was someone who grew up. My parents had bought a homestead at the end of Clark Road. And there used to be a children's home that was at the end of Clark Road as well. It was kind of like a Y. You went to the left for my parents and to the right for the home. Well, Eric grew up there, and I'd known him ever since I was 6 and a half years old. So I was just here halfway around the world is a face of my childhood. It was amazing. But the story really doesn't stop there. After my first trip on a tour, I went back several times on tours. And then I came to actually live in Jerusalem. I'm a long-term volunteer. Well, Eric and Joan have become family to me there. Eric has a little barbershop called Eric of Alaska. And there's an igloo on his sign. So in Jerusalem, there's a little like piece of Alaska there. When I go to their home for dinner, we share memories like the days when there were no subdivisions on Lazy Mountain. And we had no idea where the property boundaries were, so we just wandered everywhere. Clark Road used to be a little gravel, windy, narrow road, and there was a spot called Letty's Dip. And the story goes that one of the house parents, Aunt Letty, They were going in a car that was going too fast, and when it went through this dip, she caught some air and screamed. So things like that from your childhood. The home had a herd of black Swiss cows, cattle, I don't know what the proper term is, but they had a dairy farming operation. And in the summer, they would make silage for the cattle for the winter. They had a kind of a trough thing that the sides were probably 10, 12 feet high, and the floor was concrete, and they would put the hay in it. And our kids' job was to jump off the sides of the top to pack it down. And we loved it, of course, but my mom wasn't too thrilled when we'd come home green. And she had to figure out how to get our clothes not green. But it was an idyllic childhood. It was really, I can't think of anywhere else that I would rather have grown up. So in the city where I live, it's intense. There's a lot of stress. It's complicated. It's complex. It's such a blessing for me to have one place where I can go to get grounded, to connect with my roots, to live in a simpler time. And so I'm grateful that a chance encounter, because I said yes to take some things to somebody that I didn't know, has led to a really deep and rich friendship. And there is a piece of Alaska in Jerusalem. And that's my story.
Aren't these great stories? My goodness, love it. Hopefully you're thinking, oh, I've got a story I can tell. We're going to take a little bit of a break right now. We're going to take an intermission. And we have Bistro Red Beet, who's out in the lobby. Did I say that right? And they have some wonderful looking scrumptious treats. So please stand up, enjoy yourself. And I think we're going to have some more beautiful organ music. So one more round of applause for these four. And we'll take about a 15-minute break. How about? Thank you very much. Okay, we are back. And before we begin with our next four wonderful stories, we're going to have Pat Chesbrough, the president of the board of Palmer Museum, speak to you. Let's give a round of applause.
So it may look like this comes together without anybody doing anything, but first of all, we have wonderful storytellers who prepare their stories and rehearse and stand in front of a mirror and then stand in front of people and, in some cases, as you've already heard, sort of bare their souls about this. So I would thank the storytellers first. And none of these events happen without a producer, somebody who pulls all the pieces together and makes it happen and runs around at the last minute. And there's been a couple of last minute things this time, and that's Betty Pierce. And then the storytellers are fortunate enough to have two coaches who help them out with their stories. And we've gone to having two rehearsals now, and everyone wasn't able to make two, but everybody has obviously practiced a lot. But the two rehearsals help people to kind of get through it the first time and then get some ideas about how to make it better and keep working at it and try it again. And so I would like to thank Emily Forstner and Kai West for that. Now, the other part of it that's really exciting is that Radio Free Palmer has recorded in the past, and tonight they're streaming the stories. So thanks to Mike Malefsky and Lee Henriksen and all the folks. So Betty was, I don't think you heard this, but Betty said her sister in Nova Scotia is listening, and she listened to both her sisters speak tonight, so that's kind of exciting. Also, Alice, you have done a wonderful job. How wonderful it is for us to have songs that we can sing along to. You may not have heard us because you were playing the organ, but there were a whole bunch of us singing with your last song. I think we should sing the Alaska flag song afterward. Does everybody know it? Some of us do. So we'll do that. Actually, we'll do that before we start the next one because people tend to leave fast. So we'll do it before we start the next one, if that's okay. So I do have another person to thank, and that is our executive director for the Palmer Museum, and that is Selena Ortega Chalero, and she does great work. I know that she and her husband Richard were doing the programs at the last minute this afternoon, and so that's kind of doing a lot in the line of duty, so thanks, Selena, for everything. Also, we have some board members here from the board, and the Palmer Museum Board is really working hard to make this an important aspect of our community. We hope you come by and see. We have a great exhibit right now about women in the Senate, and if you haven't been to see it, you should. I was wandering around the other day, and I said, well, it seems like there's a lot of people that have their pictures in more than once. But at this point, at the point of when they did this, there were only 14 women in the U.S. Senate. So, of course, their pictures, they have to take more than one picture of them to make it look like there's more, I guess. I don't know. So we're hoping for more at some point in time. Lisa Murkowski is photographed. There's lots of wonderful legislators photographed. So our board members who are here, I know Cliff Fletcher is here. He's in the back. Is Kim here? No, Kim Carver is also a board member. Annie Bill is here. She's on the board. Jim Beck is on the board. He's here. Dossie Boyd is on the board. She's here. Who have I missed? Me. Brooke. Brooke Heppenstall is out helping with the Red Bistro Red Beat. And Bill Pendleton is also on the board. So we're always, we always are thankful for the people that are willing to spend their time making the museum a better place.
We're going to sing. Everyone is going to sing. Yes, let's stand in honor of our wonderful state, the best state, of course. Eight stars of gold on a field of blue, Alaska's flag may it mean to you. The blue of the sea, the evening sky, the mountains, lakes, and the flowers nearby, the gold of the earth. Gold of the hills and streams, the brilliant stars in the northern sky, the Bear, the Dipper, and shining high, the great North Star with a steady light, o'er land and sea, a beacon. Alaska's flag to Alaskans dear, a simple flag of the last frontier. Ooh, that was a stretch for me. That key. Good job, you guys. So here we are in this beautiful church. Here's a quote from Shannon L. Alder. God is going to send you someone that will rescue you. And then one day, you will rescue them in return. And together, your stories will rescue others. He has always been a God of rescues, and a maker of warriors for his grace. Our next untold story is by Teresa Roy, and it's called Chains Unbound. Let's welcome Teresa.
Hello. Really close? Okay. When I was 19, I was married for the first time, and when I mistakenly thought that a piece of paper could somehow fix a lot of personal shortcomings, I'm sure some of you know what I'm talking about. We had a child in our first year, and while I was learning to be a new mom and to care for a newborn and all the work that that entails, two of my husband's old friends showed up, and that was cocaine and vodka, and later on they were joined by heroin. And my vision of a happy family became the reality of living with a drug addict. By the time my son turned 2, we had divorced. And you know, they say that a woman will leave and come back to an abusive relationship multiple times before she leaves for good. And after a time, I did leave for good. But somehow my husband, my former husband then, would kind of worm his way back into my life, whether he needed a place to live or food or money or whatever. So after a few years, and when he came to me and said he was moving to Oregon to get his life back on track, I was really relieved because I needed to get my life back on track also. And as long as he was around, the hurricane that was his existence was swamping my life, and I was going down the tubes just as fast as he was, and I had a child to raise. Within the first year of Ron moving to Oregon, he was involved in a drunk driving accident with a fatality. He was sentenced to 8 years in prison. During that time, I remarried. I moved back out to the valley where my family was from, and I was really putting my life back together, and things were going really well for me. And when he would occasionally call our son or send a letter, it was very confusing for Nick. And it was disruptive. It was disruptive to my life. It was disruptive for my new family. And I remember having a heated conversation with him where I said, please just leave us alone. Just let us be. And you just go and do whatever you're going to do, but leave us alone. And he did. And for 10 years, we didn't hear anything from Ron. Until one day the phone rang, and it was Ron. And he asked if he could send a letter to our son. It was his only child, and he was doing well, and would I allow that? So I agreed to, if he would write a letter, that I would give that to Nicholas. And he did. And that began a period of time where my son began to get to know his biological father. By this time, he was almost 15, and the subject of a visit came up. Ron was still living in Oregon, and my son was very excited to go. Ron had remarried, I had spoken with his new wife, and I felt comfortable that it would be all right. So on a Friday morning, I drove him into Anchorage and dropped a very excited teenager off at the airport to go meet his dad, really, for the first time that he would remember. And I got home, now this is before cell phones, and the phone rang, and it was Belinda, Ron's wife. And she said, Teresa, I am so sorry. There was an incident of domestic violence at our house last night, and Ron is in jail. And I was livid, and I was frantic, because I had just put my 15-year-old on an airplane, and the person who was supposed to pick him up at the other end was in jail. And I couldn't believe that, again, I had allowed this to happen. And I don't remember all the details, but I can tell you that my son returned home safely, but he never spoke to his father again. And this time when Ron called and begged for forgiveness and said he was sorry, we shut the door, and this time I nailed it shut because that was not going to happen again. Well, it's funny how life works, isn't it? Because the things that bound us together weren't quite finished yet. Because one night, we're talking years later, my son now has grown up, he's an adult, he has his own family. And I have the most vivid dream, and I can tell you 20 years later what I felt and what I saw. It's just vivid to me. I saw a man in the distance, and he was walking kind of hunched over like this. And as I drew closer to him, I saw that his feet were shackled together, and he had heavy chains around his neck. And as I drew closer to him, and he turned around, I saw that it was Ron. And as I began to speak to him in my dream, the chains began to break away, and he stood upright. And that morning, when I woke up, I knew what I needed to do. And I wrote a letter to him. And I don't remember everything that was in the letter, but I can tell you the words just flowed out. And there were two weights that were laid down that day, the one that I had carried and the one that I required of him. And I addressed the letter, and I sent it to him in Oregon. I went away for the weekend, and when I returned on Monday, there was a message on my answering machine, and I listened to it, and it was Ron, and he said, "I got your letter. It meant a lot to me. Thank you. But the reason I'm calling is that I'm living in a homeless shelter in Colorado, and your letter was hand-delivered to me. I knew I was meant to have it. I'm living in a homeless shelter in Colorado. You sent the letter to Oregon in 3 days. The letter was hand-delivered to me. I've been talking to a priest here, and I'm going to kick it this time. I'm going to call you soon. Please tell Nick that I love him." And a few days later, I got one of those early morning phone calls that you know aren't going to be good. And the voice on the other end said, "Teresa, he's dead. Ron died of a brain aneurysm yesterday, and I wanted you to know." I don't know what Ron's last days were, but I think he walked in hope. I think he walked in forgiveness, and I know he stood a little taller. Thank you.
Thank you for that. Behind all of your stories is always your mother's story, because hers is where yours began. A quote from Mitch Albom. Here is Vicki Randolph to share a mother's story about a poetic redemption. Let's welcome her.
Is anyone in this room recovering from raising a teenager? Is anyone in this room still raising a disobedient teenager? This story is for you, and it's called Poetic Redemption. My daughter and I have a wonderful relationship now. She lives in Minneapolis. She's an accomplished woman, and I'm very, very proud of her. But it hasn't always been that way. The first 12 years of her life, she was a near-perfect child. She was obedient and sweet and helpful. She did her chores on time, and she studied well. She got good grades in school. She chose her friends well. wasn't always like that, and it certainly wasn't like that when she got older. One day, one fall day, right after sixth grade started, my lovely little girl left home with her backpack on her back, and in the few hours that she was at school, she was abducted by aliens. The person or creature that returned to my doorstep that evening looked like my daughter, and she was wearing my daughter's clothes, and she was carrying my daughter's backpack, but this was not my daughter. This brat was defiant and belligerent and argumentative, and she was a lying, cheating little thief. Even her voice was different. This went on for almost a year. That year was filled with arguments and battles, and as the fall season transitioned into winter, her sweet disposition went south with the geese, and her demeanor became as cold and icy as that winter wind that blows down the Matanuska Valley River. Fortunately, she was involved with her youth group at church. This creature and her friend had this fabulous scheme that involved a series of lies in three families, and I caught them in the middle of it. So with the youth pastor and the church pastor and the parents that were involved in this scheme, we did an alien exorcism of sorts on this alien child and her friend. My daughter was back for a while. After all, we're talking about a teenage girl. During that year, my dark brown hair turned to dark gray. Fast forward 3 years. She's now 16. She's getting her driver's license. Some of you may remember what that was like. Fortunately for her and for me, we survived that ordeal with no wrecked vehicles, and she ended up with a driver's license. And in her mind, that license was a ticket to adulthood and a rite of passage for freedom. All hell broke loose. My daughter was again abducted, and another alien showed up, but this one was bigger and louder and more belligerent and hormonal. For the next 2 years, somebody in our household cried themselves to sleep every night. Mostly it was me. My dark gray hair turned to silver. In spite of herself, two car accidents, and a series of bad decisions, she was able to graduate from high school. But in her mind, she was an adult, so she moved out into a one-bedroom apartment with two roommates. She worked two part-time jobs to pay her rent and her car payment and her SR-22 insurance and hopefully have money left over for groceries. Somewhere in that period of time, she grew up just a little bit, and the Wicked Witch of the North got just a tiny bit wiser. I was encouraging her to go on to school, and finally she agreed. She chose a school in Minnesota, and off she went. A year or so later, she came home for Christmas break. By now she was 20. This time, it was my daughter that came home. She was back to that fun-loving, charismatic young woman, and we had a wonderful time that Christmas. She had fun with me, I had fun with her. She was able to enjoy her friends without getting into trouble. On New Year's morning, she stumbled up the stairs pretty with sleepy eyes, walked into the kitchen, and like I've done hundreds of times before, I gave her a big hug and a kiss on the cheek and a little swat on her rear end. Her eyes filled with tears, and I thought, oh, she's really remembering how wonderful this relationship we used to have feels. I thought those were tears of happiness. Fast forward a few more years and more ordeal. It wasn't that she grew up and stayed grown up, she regressed and the alien came back many times. A couple of years later, she'd graduated from school. She was working two jobs to now pay for her student loans. and she was able to buy a house. So I flew down to Minneapolis to help her move. And during that time, our relationship had transitioned from parent and disobedient teen to adult and adult. And she also felt like she was free to share some of these secrets that she had previously withheld from me. We were standing in the kitchen of her new home, and she said, "Hey, Mom, remember that time I came home from Christmas break? It was New Year's morning, and you swatted me on the butt, and it made me cry." And I said, "Yes, I do remember, and I thought those were tears of happiness and sentimentality, that you were so happy that our relationship was back in place." She said, "Nah, those were tears of pain." And she stood up, and she turned just a little bit, and she pulled her pant waistband down just a little bit to show a large tattoo that spanned her hip and into the cheek of her butt. And she said, "I had done this the night before, and you nailed it." "How did you know?" "I didn't." She went on to work that morning, and as I stood in her kitchen, I was having a cup of tea, and I thought, I don't know what's going on with my face. And what I realized is I had this great big smile growing on my face, and it felt evil and bad. And I was feeling really guilty because I was finding pleasure in her pain. But then, for all the tears and all the anguish and all the worry and the sleepless nights and the sacrifices and the prayers and the unfulfilled dreams, not to mention the gray hair, I felt a bit of irony that my mom radar had somehow honed in on the perfect spot on her butt. It wasn't really the perfect spot on her butt. It was the perfect spot on a fresh, raw tattoo on her butt. So for you parents out there with that teenager in your midst, hold on. Hold on, there's hope. It might take a few years. It might be just a brief moment in time. But there will be sweet, sweet justice and poetic redemption. And for me, it was an ugly tattoo on my daughter's butt.
It's perfect. Stories can conquer fear, you know, and they can make the heart bigger. That's a quote from Ben Okri. Jillian Moon has a very big heart. She will now share her story called Daddy's Girl. Let's welcome her.
Okay, here we go. So, I grew up not knowing who my real father was. Didn't have a clue. My mother would never speak of him. I think I was in my teens before she even told me his name. So, I'm British, in case you can't tell. And one Sunday afternoon, I'm laying by the pool in Wimbledon with my godmother. That's my mom's bestie. It's about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. She's laying on the sun lounger, big old floppy hat, dark glasses, and a martini in one hand and a cigarette in the other. Wait, so that must mean it was 5 o'clock, right? Anyway, I digress. So I had just got off the phone with my mom. My mom and I do not have the best relationship. Most of our phone calls back in the day were a little contentious. She was remarried to her husband, and she and her husband had a perfect boy child. and the three of them were the absolute perfect family unit. They were there, and I was here. I didn't get on with any of them. I didn't follow in the same footsteps. I was very different. I was this alien child. And my mother said as much. She actually said she found me under a rock in Nottingham Forest because I was so... And you see my bio, Robin Hood is my great-great-great-great uncle, three times removed on my dad's side. But anyway, so I'm sitting with my godmother, and I'm furious. I just got off the phone, and I'm raging, and she's heard this story a million times. I'm always raging about how I feel with my family, and she's laying there, and I'm like, oh, my gosh, I can't believe it. And I said, Lucy, are you listening to me? She says, yes, darling, absolutely. Your mother is a pain in the butt. Your brother, yes, I'm listening. And she took another sip. And I had said this before, that I want to find my real dad. I had looked many, many times in a lot of different ways. And finally, I swung over my feet over on the chair. I sat there and said, Lucy, will you help me find my dad? And she froze. She took her glasses off and she said, what did you say? I said, will you help me find my dad? She got up, she went into the house, opened a drawer, pulled out a piece of paper with a name and a phone number on it. I'm like, what? She said, wait, don't wait. Let me tell you. So apparently, this is how the story goes. She and my mom's Trinidadian, they're both Trinidadian, and Trinidad was a colony of the UK. They came to Europe, to England, and catted around and had fun. And when my mom met my dad, they all used to hang out together. My real dad apparently used to run the London Underground, and he was a big music person. They used to hang out with some very famous music groups with some guy who had big rubbery lips that you guys might know, and they used to all play together. So my mom and him got together, they were really in love, and she got pregnant with me. And they used to hang out in South London, and his home and station, main station for the Underground, was at the North Country. So when she found out she was pregnant, she went to look for him. She was all excited about that. First baby and everything, right? So she gets off the tube and goes to see a station and comes out of the local, what is like a Walmart, but a drugstore. And he was coming out with a woman and kids in a pram, which is a stroller. Thank you. Yeah, stroller. So he never saw her. She turned around, got back on the train and disappeared. Left London, went up to Nottingham, and had me, and proceeded never to mention his name again. She made Lucy swear that Lucy would never, ever tell me who that was. And Lucy countered that said, if the child asks me directly, I will not lie to her. Well, so I'm furious, right? I'm like livid, I grab it, she says, think about it. I'm like, no, I pick up the phone and I call it and I say, my name is Jillian, and you're my dad, my mother is, and he's like, whoa, dude, no. And very thick Scottish accent. And I'm like, yes, blah, 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 blah. I need to see you right now. Where are you? He's like, no. But anyway, so I go, right? I go running and she's coming on the tube with me and I'm like, you cannot stay with me. And she's like, think about it. I'll give you a drink, think about it. I get off the tube, I go running to the door. Knock on the door, somebody opens it, and I look, I'm like, yeah, not you. And I walk in, and there are a lot of people there. They're having a bit of a party. And he comes out of the kitchen, and I'm like, he looks at me, I look at him, he says, holy. The height, the weight, everything. He was white, red-haired and blue-eyed, but we looked exactly alike. So we go into the bedroom and we have a we're standing there, and then there's do-do-do-do-do-do. And Lucy comes flying up the stairs and he's standing there looking at me. He looks around and he's like, Lucy. And she's like, hey, hello, a-hole, is what she said. So we go into the bedroom and we have a conversation for maybe 45 minutes. And then he comes out, puts his hand around me. There are about 40 people in the room. And he says, "Ladies and gentlemen, meet my black bastard."
Ouch.
I have a feeling that's not the end of the story. Yes. So, how do we follow that? Thanks, Jillian. Yeah, we could do a part two. Okay. Survival. Okay. Let's go on. Here's a great quote. "After nourishment, shelter, and companionship, stories are the things that we need most in the world." That's from Philip Pullman. All needs are met in this final untold story by Emily Forstner called Physics Project. Let's welcome Emily.
Yeah, how do you follow that? I'll try. The young man, he was sitting right next to my desk, and he looks up and he goes, "Hey, Forstner, do you believe in guardian angels?" I said, It gives me pause. It was our senior year, and my friends were threatened with failing science if they didn't finish their physics project for Mr. Edwards. So we got our heads together and we decided, let's go build a snow cave and go winter camping during spring break in Rocky Mountain National Park. So we go to Mr. Edwards, and he tells us everything we ever needed to know about building a snow cave, and then he added some stories about his adventures he had in the wilderness. Now, Mr. Edwards was a young, dynamic teacher, and he was absolutely genius. He would give us ideas and have us realize that we could be more than we ever thought possible. Plus, he showed me a lifestyle I didn't even know existed before. So we gathered all his recommended gear on my front porch, and we made count. Now, this was the late 70s, so we all had the obligatory short down ski jacket and the down sleeping bag and the Levi's with plenty of holes in them and cotton T-shirts. And, oh, yeah, we threw in a couple of shorts and a tank top because, well, it was going to be spring break. We put it in our borrowed backpacks and we loaded it up into my dad's 1966 Red International Harvester. It was a beast. You could fit a small town in this thing, let alone six seniors. And that's how Marty and Louise and Dave and Kyle and Randy and Lisa and I found ourselves on our way to Estes Park. Now, to get from Loveland to Estes Park, you go up Big Thompson Canyon. And at Drake, you make a left, and at the Y at Estes, you make a right. You go 6 more miles to the entrance, and after the entrance, it's 9 more miles to Bear Lake parking lot, our final destination. And when we get there, we pile out, we look up, we go, whoa, I think we dodged a bullet here because the forecast was for a spring snowstorm. Looks good to me. So we all started up on the trail. Well, about 2.5 hours later, we get the first snowflake, and the forecast proved true. It was going to be one of those epic spring snowstorms in the mountains where you can't see the hand in front of your face, and we have big, deep, soft, wet Colorado snowflakes. And it wasn't long before we were wet and Lisa was shivering, just like Mr. Edwards told us to be careful about. So we decide to build a fire, which was easier said than done, considering the circumstance. Everything was covered in snow, and what wasn't was wet. You know, I don't know why we were so surprised it was winter. But we decide to build that snow cave. And we get going on that snow cave as if our very lives depended on it. And pretty soon we had it, or soon enough, we had it big enough for what we thought would be good for 6 people. We sandwiched Lisa in between 2 people and a sleeping bag like Mr. Edwards told us to. And we all crawled into that snow cave. Woo! That was a close one. And then we heard the first drip. And then another drip. And you got it. Our engineering was slightly faulty, and the snow cave was melting. So now not only was our coats wet, our sleeping bags were wet. And so we decided we should just head for home. So we all get out of the snow cave, and we wrap the bags around us like blankets because our coats are worthless, and we gather our gear the best we can, and we start off. Problem is, we can't find the trail because at least 12 inches of snow have fallen. But we use our physics knowledge, and we know that what goes up must come down. So we figure if we just turn around and go the way we came, we will eventually find that road. So we take off. And every now and then, we would count off to 6. And if anybody didn't yell out their number, we would stop and look for them. Because we knew enough that this was going to take a group effort to find the road. And we walk. And we walk. We walk uphill. We walk downhill. We walk through the woods. We take over some rocks. But you know what? We found the road. Whew! Oh, that was a close one. So we turn and start to walk up to Bear Lake parking lot and get into the truck. And we see in the foreground coming toward us, it looks like headlights. But you can't really tell because it's still snowing. And as it comes near, it sure is a car. So we huddle next to the side of the road, and up next to us comes and drives up this blue Vega. Now, if you guys don't know what a Vega is, it was the industry's attempt to make something like a Rambler look sporty. And there wasn't a Vega on the road without 2 dents and a missing muffler, and this was no exception. The driver rolls down the window, and we see inside this like 30-year-old looking man with bulging blue eyes, premature balding, stringy blonde hair to his shoulders, a couple days worth of peach fuzz on his chin, and a 6-pack of Coors in the console. Now, I tell you this because we're from Colorado, and I know we're all thinking the same thing. Coors. That's no upstream beer. That's no downstream beer. Why, that's no beer at all. So we say, hey, what are you doing? He goes, oh, I live in Greeley, and sometimes after work on Saturday nights, I like to drive up to the park and check it out. Really? Let me give you a visual. That would be like somebody living in Potter's Marsh on a Saturday night about midnight in a blizzard, deciding that it would be fun to get in his beater Ford Fiesta, drive to Wasilla, up to Hatcher Pass, all the way to Summit Lake. This did not make sense. He goes, what are you doing? We're going up to Bear Lake parking lot to get into our truck. He goes, no, you're not. You're headed toward Estes Park. You could hear the collective gasp as reality kind of centered on us. And I don't think we'd ever been scared at any point before this. But when we realized that we no longer knew the difference between up and down, and we had at least 15 miles to go in our current condition, well, let's say it was humbling. He goes, can I take you to the parking lot? We said, sure, why not? So we all get in the Vega, and who doesn't fit in the Vega goes on the hood, and who doesn't fit on the hood stands on the rear bumper, and he gives each of us a beer, and we go to the Bear Lake parking lot. We get to the parking lot, and he goes, I want to make sure your truck starts. So we get out, I turn on the truck, turn on the heater. He waves goodbye, and we watch him put it in reverse. We look and see his taillights head off to Greeley. We said, wow. That was a close one. And we drove home. Well, my friends got an F on the project, like Mr. Edwards said, you know, your snow cave did fail. But they got to be in the class because they lived. And we all graduated and we went on to do extraordinary and ordinary things. And I found myself in Alaska as a public school teacher, like Mr. Edwards. And I can only hope that over the years, I have been able to inspire my kids to be more than they ever thought possible, to go out there and live bold and brave lives, and to tell the tales. So when that kid next to me said, "Hey, Forstner, do you believe in guardian angels?" I said, "Yeah." "Dude, I met one."
Awesome. That's fantastic. What a great story. Wow. So we're going to close this evening with a quote from the great Maya Angelou. "There is no greater agony than bearing an untold story inside you." Yes, she's talking to you. Have you a story that should be told? Now you can end that agony. Write it down. Submit it to the palmermuseum.org/untoldstories. Our next episode is in January. It's called Surviving. Yeah, that's the one. The story that you were just thinking about, that's the one you should write down. Submit it. We want to thank you once again for supporting our Palmer Museum and coming to Untold Stories. And we finally want to bring all of our storytellers up to face you so you can snap some pictures and give them a big round of applause. All the stories, and I'm going to sing to you while you come up here. "We love the stories that you told. You were brave and you were bold. It's exciting to think of writing Mayan stories that's untold." Thank you, guys.